Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
You have to remember the bad to appreciate the good.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast that goes beyond the good and bad of the Iditarod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we start to wax philosophical, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
That was four time in a row, former Iditarod champion Lance Mackey to start us off Tuesday. We are now looking at possibly having a first-time champion, though, in this year's race, as well as potentially having three women in the top 10 for the first time ever. That would be Allie Zirkel, Jesse Royer, and maybe Paige Drobny if she hangs on. And though this would be his first Iditarod championship, the guy in the lead knows something about repeat wins. They call him Repeat Kaiser because Mr. Peter Kaiser and his Kaiser Racing dogs won the tough Kuskokwim 300 four times in a row from 2015 to 2018. Kaiser now leads the Iditarod heading into the final 77 miles of the 1,000-mile race. And very importantly, Kaiser has maintained that lead. His team was 50 minutes ahead of defending champ Your Life Seth Olsom going into the Elim checkpoint late Monday night. Heading toward White Mountain, Kaiser was only a couple miles ahead of Olsom according to the race GPS tracker, and then he still arrived about 40 minutes ahead of Olsom. That was 8:05 Tuesday morning, and according to tradition, the church was ringing its bell.
Sebastian. He was here.
Peter.
All right, puppy!
Oh, welcome to Wayne Mountain.
Buddy, thank you.
The bell, not frozen this year. If he's going to win, Kaiser must continue to hold off the defending champion.
Yeah, he's a tough competitor. We've been traveling together for quite a while, and he's had some issues and stuff with his team, but he never goes away, and I wouldn't have expected him to, so not surprised at all that we're sitting here together after several hundred miles of traveling together. But yeah, he's tough, and I mean, he's got just as good a shot at winning this as I do, so it'll be probably be fun for the fans tomorrow, or today, or I guess it'd be today. Yeah, it's fun, you know, it's kind of what we've been working towards for a long time, so it's rewarding just to be sitting here as one of the top two teams, and like I said, aside from that, we'll see how it goes tomorrow.
Kaiser moved into the lead after Nicholas Petit's team quit Sunday night on the sea ice between Shaktulik and Koyuk. It wasn't far from where Petit had veered off the trail in last year's Iditarod, and that all allowed Olsom to slip by and win. Petit, who had led most of this year's race, eventually scratched. The Iditarod says he and his 10-dog team were brought back to Shaktulik by snow machine and sled. Petit had told a reporter for Iditarod Insider out on the ice that the dogs got into a fight right before balking on the sea ice, and he says he thinks they remembered having a bad time in that area in 2018. Petit also talked to longtime veteran musher Didi Johnro, who is not running the Iditarod anymore, or so she says, but doing commentary this year for Anchorage TV station KTUU. Johnro described Petit's issues as a mental health problem among all of the dogs in the team. She said they seemed pretty bummed out when she went to visit him in that cabin that's a ways outside of Shaktulik. We heard from Nick about this. It's a pretty sad-sounding Nick. Could have been a lack of coast leaders to get out on that sea ice. Completely different terrain than some dogs are used to. The dogs in Pete Kaiser's team and other Yukon Kuskokwim mushers, they do a lot of training on ice. It might not be sea ice, but it's big, flat, wide-open spaces that they can kind of get used to out there. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend like this isn't a bummer that Nick had to drop out of the race and what happened to him. He's very gregarious. He's got an accent a little bit still. Just an interesting, colorful guy. And I think anybody that's a fan of the Iditarod is kind of sad that he had to drop out. Here's a story just apropos of nothing, but when he finished seventh in 2015, in Nome, it was very early in the morning, the wee hours of the morning. I had sort of signed off for the day as far as work was concerned, and I convinced him to come into Mark's Soap and Suds. That's a sort of a bar, restaurant, slash laundromat. And because he had finished in seventh, I bought Nick 7 cheeseburgers. 7 Big Mark burgers, they call them out there at Mark's Soap and Suds. Well, P. Kaiser is not making any cheeseburger plans yet, nor is he picking out the color of the pickup truck that he might win.
Well, just do what we've been doing, I guess. It's just another dog run, so nothing special. At this point, we've kind of played most of our cards, and we'll just run them into Nome and see how they do.
We will have to wait and see because, and we always say this, anything can happen. We talked a lot about this way back in season 2, episode 14, and we're here season 3, episode 14. It's not a coincidence. Teams can lose this race at any point, but this is the most critical point where that can happen. Like, it happened to Jeff King in 2014. Again, way more about that back in season 2, episode 14. I'm not going to go off on that tangent just yet. Back to this year's race, if Kaiser's team can hang on all the way to the Burled Arch finish line in Nome, it'll be his first Iditarod win in 10 races. That includes 5 top 10 finishes. Olsom, though hot on his heels, has never finished outside the top 10, and he still has a shot at winning this year. Here's Olsom with our trail reporter KNOM's Ben Matheson in White Mountain.
Yeah, you just gotta run your dogs and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts for the final 77 miles and how to make that run into Nome with a fast dog team in front of you?
Yeah, go as fast as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, you give it all and hope it works out.
And eight hours here, what can you expect in terms of that rest, and what do you hope to accomplish out of these 8 hours?
Yeah, you get some good food in them and they get to sleep out, and they should be feeling pretty good about themselves when they wake up, so.
And was it Olive, your leader, that you dropped way back when?
Yeah.
How has your leadership, your leaders, been doing on the coast now?
On the coast, they've been doing fantastic. I mean, they might be the best leaders I've ever had on the coast. Yeah. I'm kind of surprised.
What are their names?
Darge has been doing phenomenal, and Phoenix has been up there with him, and Rusern, and Yuar.
So you're going to have some good dogs out there pulling for him, and a lot of fans pulling for him as well. By the way, hello to anyone in his home country of Norway who is listening. Thanks for joining us. Plenty of fans pulling for Pete Kaiser, too. He could be the first Alaska Native musher to win since John Baker in 2011. That connection to mushing for Indigenous people is something that goes back a long way, far before the white man ever came to Alaska. How that has changed is something I've talked to people about and written about in the past, and I'm going to tweet a link to a Fairbanks Daily News Miner story I wrote. I'll actually pin that to my Twitter profile. How about that's twitter.com/KCGROVE. The headline of that story, if you want to go find it, is Mushing a Flickering Flame in Interior Alaska Villages. So I wanted to figure out a way to share that reporting from a couple years ago. I will be tweeting that out. Anyway, it's looking like an already very competitive 2019 Iditarod is heading for an exciting finish for the frontrunners. My best guess is 3:30, 4 a.m. Wednesday for the front of the pack to start coming into Nome. Again, anything can happen. Meanwhile, some of mushing's most decorated champions are running nowhere near the front of the Iditarod pack, and they're all right with that. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes has a report here on 2 veterans that are learning to run a totally different kind of race.
I got girls in heat. Let me go for it. If you just grab a handful of line. Yeah, just, all right, girl.
Every year when Martin Boozer gets to Unalakleet, he's handed a big bag of muktuk from the same little boy.
Awesome, man, oh man, you've grown a couple of feet since last year.
I got this for you.
You got some muktuk. Thank you so much, buddy. Appreciate it. This time I'm not going to eat it all at once.
Boozer seems to know just about everyone at the checkpoint, greeting people by name with a smile. He's in such high spirits that you'd never guess the 4-time Iditarod winner is running solidly in the middle of the pack. His dogs are fine, but he's smiling through an injury that makes him wince every now and again as he's handling his dog chores.
My hip is kaput.
Kaput?
My kaput is a German word. It's been kaput for a while. Oh, and he goes out of whack. And then I can't hardly stand up. It's that burning, burning pain that's kind of like a fire. Like a fire in the back.
Still, the pain is not the hardest part. Boozer says his challenge right now is trying to relax, to not compete, but focus on enjoying his dog team.
The interesting thing is I thought I could just turn it off. But the guy can't, after 30 some years of hopefully competitive racing, it seems like it's not so easy to just decide that you're not competitive. It takes a bit of work to relax to the point where you can unrace.
Learning to unrace, that's Boozer's way of putting it. Lance Mackey has another perspective. He's competing, just not against anyone else.
You know, I'm still in a race. I'm not racing anybody particular, but I'm still racing me and my team.
Mackey won 4 Iditarods back to back, but he has serious health problems. The last time he ran the race in 2016, he had to scratch. Among the biggest problems are his hands. They can no longer stand the cold, which is a major liability handling dogs in the Alaska winter.
We're managing. They're not ever going to be right, and I've learned to deal with it, but as days go on and the less sleep I get, the harder it seems to keep out of my head.
To keep his hands working, Mackey has to get extra rest, something that rules out competing at the grueling, sleep-deprived front of the pack. He's focusing on getting his dogs experienced along the trail in case they run it again, even with someone else driving the team. Aside from his physical limitations, one of the biggest challenges remains mental. On the long runs, especially the white wall of the Yukon River, Mackey doesn't try to bat away the dark thoughts, but works through them.
I don't even try to hold them back. If they happen to come into your mind, just go with it. It is part of our experience out here. You have to remember the bad to appreciate the good. And if anybody here says it's always been good, they're full of crap. It's not always going to be good. It's not always glamorous. It's not all going to be, you know, you're not always going to have a good day. Dogs ain't always going to have a good run. They're going to have a bad day too. Just hopefully ain't all at the same time.
Mackey says he'll take his time getting up the coast, but absolutely expects to finish the race. In Unalakleet, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Some really interesting perspective, some wisdom there from Lance Mackey and Martin Boozer. There's an extended cut of that interview with Martin posted on the Iditapod. Both of those guys have, of course, won the big award multiple times, but as you've probably gathered, there are other awards along the way. And that brings us to our listener question, which comes to us all the way from down under.
Hi, this is Victoria calling from Australia. I have a question about the prizes that mushers sometimes win at the checkpoints that they pass through. I can't imagine that if you're trying to win the Iditarod that having a sum of money in $1 bills or a number of golden nuggets on your sled helps you in any way. So what do the mushers do with those things so that they're not weighing down their sleds?
Hey, great question. And sort of fitting because Ben and I are sitting in Unalakleet right now, and Unalakleet is one of the places where a prize is given to mushers. So up and down the trail at multiple checkpoints, mushers are gifted awards. Many of them come from major corporate sponsors, and it's a way to highlight their contributions to the race. So the first musher into McGrath, the first one to reach the Yukon, the first one to Caltag, the first one to Unalakleet, and there are more. And you're right, it would be inconvenient for mushers to take some of the prizes that they win in these places with them in the sled. For example, the first musher to reach the Yukon not only gets a 5-course dinner, but they also get $3,500 in single bills that are piled up sort of like a prop on a plate while the musher eats. And it's kind of for show because actually a check is just cut later. In Unalakleet, Nick Petit was the first one in, and he was given an award. It was $1,500 in gold nuggets, which was presented to him inside of a hand-woven grass basket, and also an ivory carving of a sled dog team. beautiful sculpture by an artist from the community of Holy Cross, which is not too far away. And what happens is there's something like a photo op. The mushers are presented the piece of art or the token of gratitude and appreciation. They give it back, and then they keep mushing without it. At the very end of the Iditarod, Sunday in Nome, there's the musher banquet when everybody gets up and tells a story from their time on the trail, awards for sportsmanship, for best dog care, for fastest times between some of the checkpoints are announced, and then mushers are re-given the prizes that they earned earlier on the trail. So they don't have to carry these precious works of art or $3,500 in single dollar bills with them. They just get them at the end of the race. Ben, do you have anything to add?
No.
Okay. Thanks for the great question and for listening all the way in Australia.
You got to love Ben just popping in there with just a no. Sounds like he's busy. Anyway, we haven't heard as much from Ben today, KNOM's Ben Matheson, one of our trail reporters, but we sure appreciate the tape he sent us earlier from White Mountain. We might talk to him again later, who knows? But right now, we've got more Zachariah Hughes, and it's not about the funnest of subjects, one that's still very important. That's climate change. It's been a weird year for weather along the Iditarod Trail. Warm, wet conditions have hit mushers along much of the route. It's a consequence of an exceptionally bad winter for ice conditions along the Bering Sea coast. Here's Zach Hughes with that report.
Christy Barrington is having boot trouble.
Yeah, we had rain, which I'm not a fan. My stuff is constantly wet. I can't dry anything out, including my feet. But
the trail has been wet with occasional rain and sticky snow that slowed down her sled. The worst section so far was along the Yukon, heading north to Caltag.
It was like immediately after Eagle Island, it was bad. Like I said, 30 miles of just rough. Never seen water like that on the Yukon.
It's hardly just the Yukon that's less frozen than usual. Upriver from Unalakleet, long leads of open water run parallel to sections of the trail, and there's overflow.
I've never seen it like that.
Wade Mars is changing socks and lacing up his mucklucks in the Unalakleet checkpoint after a nap. He, too, is having trouble keeping things dry. But that's sort of the least of his problems. Abysmal snow cover, abundant tussocks, and aggressive moguls cracked apart his sled on the way into the Iditarod checkpoint.
Yeah, one of the runners snapped on some moguls, and then the snap piece hooked on a tussock and, like, snapped the whole seat part of my sled, just, like, ripped right off the back. So
parked on a slough in Unalakleet, Mars sled runners are different lengths. One is missing about 3 feet, and he's just had to cope with the damage for a few hundred miles. One of the more dramatic effects of the warm winter is still to come further up the trail. Norton Sound doesn't have any sea ice. Usually in March, the ice is reaching its thickest extent, but from the beach in Unalakleet, the full horizon is blue ocean water, punctuated infrequently by lone icebergs. Typically in winter, the shore is silent, save for the slight tinkling of ice shifting. This year, you can hear waves. A little bit of a jumble by the mouth of the river that looks like it's just sort of stuck there. But otherwise, I mean, it's 180 degrees of open water as far as the eye can see. The last few Iditarods have seen diminished sea ice conditions along the coast, one of the impacts of a rapidly warming Arctic. This year, freeze-up was late. Rough, warm weather has kept the sea ice from forming properly, and in February, a storm flooded areas around town.
The slough, the high water, came up above normal, and if you looked along the ocean beach, you can see where all the slush built up great big from the waves, and yeah, the slough practically broke up and lifted and moved the ice into different areas. Yeah, it's not very good at all. It's going to be a tough spring.
Mitty Johnson is a retired musher and helps run the Unalakleet checkpoint. This is the most open water he remembers ever seeing during Iditarod time.
We've had it go out before and stuff, but this year it's consistently all over Norton Sound. I mean, St. Michael Stebbins all the way up to Nome is pretty much ice-free. We'd have a lot of ice cover. I've gone out 16 miles straight out with the dog team before, and just where you can't really see much. And you haven't seen that in a long time.
The other novelty this year, Johnson says, is so much open water along sections of the river. Reroutes and damp feet during a sled dog race are inconvenient, but the consequences for people that live along the Bering Sea coast are far more dire. Johnson says it makes travel along the river significantly more dangerous when travelers break through the ice. Economically, the commercial fishing season for Red King crab had to be shut down because there's no ice through which to sink pots.
No winter crabbing.
Beyond commercial harvests, sea ice is crucial for subsistence hunting of marine mammals in the spring for communities up and down the Bering Sea and Arctic coasts. Stormy weather in Nome this year has left huge piles of snow, but hardly any sea ice. On Sunday, what ice there was snapped off and floated out to sea, leaving open water to greet the mushers as they come in. In Unalakleet, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Thanks for that, Zach. I'm still working on editing an interview with University of Alaska Fairbanks climatologist Brian Brettschneider. We have a regular segment with him called Ask a Climatologist, and we talked more about how climate change is directly affecting the Iditarod. That'll be posted as a bonus episode as soon as I get done with it. First, though, how about a snack? Take it away, Ben and Zach.
Should we sing the intro? 3, 2, 1. Snack attack with Ben and Zach. Ben, what snacks did you bring on the trail this year?
I brought a large supply of high-end granola, which when I go to the grocery store, it'll be like 30 or 40% of my grocery bill. I only own three things of value, Zach. My fat bike, my laptop, and this small bag of granola. I also picked up some Pop-Tarts and Shagluck, which I'm extremely happy with, some kimchi noodle bowl. I don't eat any of these things in real life. This probably weighs 4 pounds, but a full-size can of soup, which is a meal unto itself.
If you hauled that all along the trail?
I bought this in Anchorage, and this has been hauled the entire way.
How much food would you say from your snack pack do you not end up eating?
I hope to not eat most of this, but I already went through like the meat sticks and some of the, you know, some of the freeze-dried and some of the stuff that I had camping in Iditarod. I would make a special note of this particular bag of snack mix at the grocery store. It's like the men's vitality mix.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar.
Are you pretty impressed, or are you extremely impressed with the quality of coffee that I bartered with you today?
I'm shocked that you, a paragon of efficiency, brought small cans of cold brew all the way up the trail because they're heavy. Why did you do that?
I mean, you can do the little instant coffee packs, but I figured how nice would it be when you're filing something at midnight to just crack open a little... Crack open a cold one of 6 ounces of double espresso, whatever. And it was awesome.
What was the trade? Two Viapacks for one cold brew?
I basically didn't want cold coffee. I kind of wanted hot coffee. And I know there's a million places on earth that you can get hot coffee, but it was just kind of an impulse thing.
Now, let me ask you, you embody Homo economicus, the economical human. Do you feel like that was a rational trade, or was that just an emotional trade?
I wanted to give you a little gift, Zach, and I was going to give it to you regardless of whether we made a trade or not.
I think I said this earlier, my snack game was not as good as it has been in recent years. The biggest thing was we didn't get a caribou this year, and last year I had caribou sticks that were made. And those were the best. I think I brought 3 or 4 packs, and those got me through almost the whole time. This year, I only had 1 pack of moose sticks, and they went instantly. That was like by Takotna. Those were all gone. So I have my Starbucks Via Instant packs. I had to go to 2 grocery stores to get those, but was not willing to leave without them. My very tolerant girlfriend allowed me to just rifle through stores looking for them. This is the second bag of clementines that I bought. They travel great. When they get cold, they just get sweeter. You can stick them in your jacket pocket. Superior fruit. I have this off-brand mountain house called Backpacker's Pantry. It's a kung pao rice with chicken. And I got this from the kind folks at KTVA Channel 11 when we were posted up, I think, in Takotna. And we didn't do anything about this, but in Takotna, they ran out of propane the night the Iditarod mushers were arriving, and so there's this scramble to send people to McGrath by snow machine to get propane so that they could cook food. And as we were trying to figure out dinner, the KTVA people gave me one of these mountain houses to try, and I haven't yet because I haven't needed to, but it's like your can of soup. It's sort of like if I have to. I have a large bag of beef jerky. Oh, these are good. Instant macaroni and cheeses. You just add boiling water. Gummy worms. I forgot about these. And some gummy worms?
No, thanks. What I have to say, Zach, is that the sound of plastic bags is just giving me like deja vu of the hours of tape that I've got of mushers rifling through hundreds and hundreds of plastic bags.
I think I have more tape of them cutting open the straw bags and then strawing their dogs, and then the sound of boots on snow that's already covered in dog urine, just walking back and forth. Trail mix, and a lot of candy bars. There's Snickers here, Reese's. I already ate the Twix. Pilot Rob and I had a long flight where we had to go get fuel and sleep mute, and I was so bored and cold, and I was just eating Twix to stay warm. I gave Pilot Rob one, but I didn't tell him that it was a 4-pack of Twix, and then I felt kind of guilty that I ate 3, and I only gave Pilot Rob one. Ben, what time do you think the musher's going to arrive in Nome?
12:15 a.m. on Wednesday.
So technically Wednesday morning, just after midnight.
Do you know how much a pack of LaCroix costs in Nome, 12-pack?
No, how much?
Last year when I was there, I think it was like $10 to $11.
What's it cost in Anchorage?
It's got to be much closer to $4 to $5.
Right, what are the cold ones we've been cracking open in Unalakleet?
I've seen you crack about 6 that you've stolen from our awesome host.
Bubblies. Yeah. Well, there's no seltzer water on the trail. And anybody that knows me knows I love enjoying a cold one with the boys, by which I mean seltzer water. And so when we got to Unalakleet and awesome host Carl had pallets of bubbly, yeah, I've been a little seltzer fiend.
Zach, this is the recurring podcast segment that nobody asked for and nobody ever requested it be a recurring segment.
Ben, that wasn't a question, but I agree with you. Last year, Davis and I recorded one in a pantry surrounded by much healthier foods. Either way, we now have a table filled only with radio equipment and snacks from the grocery store.
That was delightful and tasty. And Snack Attack with Ben and Zach just rhymes so much better than Snack Attack with Zach and Davis, or Ben and Davis, or whatever. If anybody cares, I've been living off of granola bars and coffee. I've had like 20 cups of coffee every day of the race so far, except for Monday. I spilled a full cup of coffee here at work on the floor about 4 a.m. And just a minute ago, I heard someone see the spot and say, "That's a person problem. Whoever did that needs to..." I didn't hear the rest, and I didn't say anything because we don't have time for that. The race is almost over. Like I said, my best guess at a first place finisher is very early Wednesday morning, something between 3 and 4 a.m., but that's just a guess. Remember, anything can happen. Just ask Jeff King. But you'll have to do it on your own time, because that is all the time we have for today. Our theme music, it's by the band Sassafras. I am your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
And it hurt, but it's okay. It's there you go, Cloudy.
It seems like the last 2-3 years I've interviewed you in Unalakleet, you get muck-tuck, but then you got an injury too.
Like, par for the course. Well, the injuries are sporadic, I guess. The muck-tuck is hopefully a constant and very much appreciated. There you go. The last few days there was some revelations where I thought, yeah, this is mostly with the consent of my wife, you know, that's because, again, we've been so focused for so long, with her being totally okay that I'm not competitive, that makes it a lot easier.
She doesn't love you any less?
Doesn't love me any less, and still gives me all the grief I deserve, I guess.